You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of November 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
The United States has set a new goal of reducing our net greenhouse gas emissions by 26 to 28% below 2005 levels by the year 2025. This is an ambitious goal, but it is an achievable goal.
From APEC to the future of the internet to the past and present of Armistice Day, we'll be discussing the day's big stories with Kathleen Burke and Sebastian Borger, as well as this. Touchdown on a hurtling comet half a billion kilometres away. Success for the European Space Agency's Rosetta mission. We'll also speak to our man in Madrid. We'll catch up on the current Independent Projects exhibition in New York and review the latest in radio and television. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. A characteristically action-packed 58 and a half minutes ahead of us. But before all that, Paul Osborne has the latest news.
A European probe has landed on a comet, the first time that has ever happened, after a mission that holds out the prospect of learning a huge amount about the origins of the solar system. The lander from the Rosetta probe lowered itself onto the surface of the comet as both were travelling at 66,000 kilometres an hour. The journey from Earth to the comet covered nearly 6.5 billion kilometres and started a decade ago. Thomas Reiter is director of the European Space Agency.
There's a lot of new information about the origins of our solar system, of our own planet, the water which is on our planet. Does it come from such comets? Could it be that the origin of life has not evolved here on Earth, but was brought to Earth via such comets? And I think that indeed justifies all this effort.
The World Health Organization has said that the number of people killed in the Ebola outbreak in West Africa has now passed 5,100. In Mali, 90 people are under quarantine in the capital, Bamako, after a nurse died from Ebola. He had treated a man from Guinea with symptoms of the disease. The WHO is linking 4 deaths in Mali to Ebola. The UN Special Envoy on the disease, David Nabarro, says amid signs that the outbreak is slowing, the danger remains.
The signs are that in parts of West Africa where the elements are put in place, there is a slowing of the outbreak. And that's, I think, a real source of inspiration. But there are other parts of Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea where transmission is still fierce.
Russia is dismissing claims from NATO's most senior commander that it has moved troops and military equipment into eastern Ukraine this week. It's described the allegation as hot air and says there's no evidence. But General Philip Breedlove says he's sure Russia has stepped up military activities in areas controlled by pro-Moscow separatists.
Across the last 2 days, we have seen the same thing that OSCE is reporting. We have seen columns of Russian equipment, primarily Russian tanks, Russian artillery, Russian air defense systems, and Russian combat troops entering into Ukraine.
Russia's military has announced that it's restoring long-range patrol flights by bomber aircraft, which were last seen during the Cold War. The flights will extend as far as the Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean. At least one person is believed to have been killed in an explosion at a teacher training college in the north of Nigeria. The attack targeted the college in the town of Kontagora. 2 days ago, a suicide bomber disguised as a student killed at least 48 pupils. Financial regulators in the US and UK say the huge fines handed out to 5 banks for rigging foreign exchange markets are not the end of the matter. There could be prosecutions for fraud after it emerged the rates were manipulated. The fines total more than $3 billion. Martin Wheatley, who leads Britain's Financial Conduct Authority, says it's further harmed the reputation of major institutions.
The bank's failures to establish adequate systems and controls are what allowed the traders to manipulate the fixed rates across the world's largest currencies. And failings like this seriously undermine confidence in the market and undermine the attempts to genuinely reform banking culture.
President Obama says a new deal with China on greenhouse gas emissions is historic. He met the Chinese Premier Xi Jinping and afterwards said that China had agreed to work with the US to slow and eventually cut the country's carbon emissions. The two countries together produce almost half of the world's carbon dioxide. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We are back right after this.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tóquio. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
Londres. Isto é Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
From London,
London,
Canada.
This is Monocle 24. And you are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's 18:06 in London, which I'm pretty sure is 13:06 in New York. I think we've got out of that stupid time of year at which it's all 4 hours instead of the normal five. I don't know, five is so much simpler. Joining me now with their take on today's news here in the studio, I have Kathleen Burke, Professor Emerita of Modern and Contemporary History at UCL, and Sebastian Borger, correspondent for Berliner Zeitung and Der Standard, among others. Welcome both. We will look first at APEC, coverage of which has mostly focused on the spectacle of Asia-Pacific leaders apparently dressing up as the crew of Starship Enterprise, and Xi Jinping and Shinzo Abe holding a let's-see-who-can-look-least-pleased-to-meet-you contest, scored by most observers as a draw. Some actual work did get done, however, notably an emissions agreement concluded by the US and China. Kathleen, Obama, President Obama, calls it historic, but then he would. Is it?
Well, it's historic in that it's the first time China's not only admitted, but agreed someday in due course, that is to say by 2030, they will do something about it. I quite like it because, I like the way it's been played. I mean, what China has said is that by 2030, their emissions will have peaked, which means they're going to go up until 2030. So it's going to be a little, I don't think we're going to look next year for a decline in emissions. But yes, it is historic. Of course it's historic. It's also historic for the Americans because they refused to be part of an international agreement some time ago, as you probably remember.
Sebastian, the key word that Kathleen used there is, of course, admitted. China actually admitting that there is a problem, possibly embarrassed by the recent spectacle of people being unable to breathe in their own capital city. But how serious do you think the Chinese actually are? America has given specific targets, 26 to 28% by 2025. China, as Kathleen also pointed out, rather more vague.
Very indeed, yes. I still think, given what we know, what we've had over the years from China and the denials and the sort of dismissive attitude saying, you do something, we need to industrialize, we need to develop, leave us alone. I think it is a pretty big step.
Do you think that China just has been, sticking with you, Sebastian, they are the world's biggest polluter, which is not a name anybody wants. But do you think they have been, the very fact of the visibility now of the pollution, the fact that, on some days it's not safe to go outside in Beijing, do you think they've actually started to understand that there really is a problem here?
Complete madness, isn't it? I absolutely agree. I have friends living in both Beijing and Shanghai. The kids can't go out on certain days during winter. Complete madness. And I do think there is a increasing civil society which asks questions about that. And there, of course, whatever else we think about their political system, If that kind of knowledge reaches the leadership and the leadership thinks we have to do something about it, then they can act rather more quickly sometimes than we in our democracies.
On the subject of we in our democracies, Kathleen, the issue of pollution, climate change, etc., call it what you will, like everything else in America now, has become this ludicrous partisan arm wrestle whereby the facts are really less relevant than who takes which side of the argument. Is President Obama, having just taken the beating that he did in the midterms, going to be able to go home and sell this as a diplomatic triumph? Is he even going to bother trying?
Well, he has to try. I mean, he thinks it is a diplomatic triumph and is indeed a diplomatic triumph. The problem is, of course, is the relevant committees in the Congress, especially in the Senate. One of them is now going to be led by one of the great climate change deniers. Things are going to be difficult to get through the Congress. There's no doubt about it. And things are going to be difficult to get through the president if he doesn't like them. He can sell it, but I think it's going to hit stasis in the way that everything else is done in the States lately.
What have we made, just finally on APEC, of the other agreements concluded between the US and China, the idea of setting up military hotlines to avoid, I guess, the kind of misunderstandings which we've seen nearly happen, not just between China and Japan, but China and the US in recent years? It actually struck me, and I'll put this to you first, Sebastian, I was one of those things which I read and I was caught between thinking, yeah, that's a good idea, and then thinking, how does this not already exist? How is there not already a way for Chinese and American military leadership to speak to each other?
I totally agree. And that's what makes it significant. Absolutely. By the way, we've seen it recently between Western countries and Russia. And Russia, of course, is part of this bigger picture. Very interesting the way China are positioning themselves a little bit closer to the US, it seems, anyway. And of course, Obama tried very hard to ignore Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, at the summit. No, I think those measures, you cannot underestimate the significance of those very small steps in as far as military, not cooperation, but at least slight understanding are concerned.
Because it is interesting, though, Kathleen, against that backdrop that Sebastian mentioned of people talking about a renewed Cold War with Russia, there seems to be this idea, not for the first time, it strikes me that China has just spent the last 25 years looking at everything Russia has done and deciding to do the complete opposite, which is actually probably not a bad benchmark. But it does seem to be a realization between China and America that they both have ambitions, but they don't want to trip over each other.
Well, it's the acceptance by the United States that China does have ambitions that's really the scene changer here, I think. The acceptance that there are now two superpowers and not just one hyperpower. And once that happens, we're back in the 19th century when you've got balance of power diplomacy, not one leader and everyone else, for better or for worse, either ignoring or just following behind. It means world affairs are going to be challenging in the next few years. Difficult, dangerous, but rather more interesting than they might have been.
Okay, well, let's move on to a domestic American story, which is one of those domestic American stories which does have implications for all of us. The Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, has announced that it's going to delay a decision on the future governance of the internet until next year. At the heart of the debate is the principle of net neutrality, which I've looked up and I now know what it means, which is exciting. This is the idea that all information that circulates on the internet should be treated equally, whereas service providers would like to be able to charge some companies to prioritize their traffic. I think I'm pretty right about that.
Absolutely. Perfect.
Excellent. Well, Sebastian, I'll ask you first. Briefly, why does net neutrality matter now that we've decided we know what it is?
Have we? Yes. Well, I suppose it's that concept of the free net and that all people are equal before the net, so to speak. No, what I find interesting, and I would probably lump this domestic decision with obviously global repercussions, and the international politics decision in the rapprochement with China together under the headline Obama Unbound, as if he has now decided I don't care anymore, I'm going to say what I think.
Because
let's see what Congress does.
Because he has come out extremely full-throatedly in favour of net neutrality. And I was thinking exactly that this is often the quite interesting part of a presidency, when you realise, I'm not going to run for anything again. Congress hates me anyway. My popularity ratings are somewhere near the Earth's core. So what? let's have fun and see if I can actually get some things done here. Do you think it is part of that, the Obama Unbound, Kathleen?
Well, I mean, even if I can't get anything done, I can at least say about it.
Exactly.
I suppose is a, oh, great. that'll be really... No, I think there are things that are going to get done, things that on the edges, one might say, that some trade deals and so forth that Congress and the president can agree on. But this net neutrality is interesting, more interesting than it sounds, I think, both because of what it means, that you don't let the big boys knock you over. On the other hand, that means perhaps you won't get your Netflix downloaded as fast as you would like. Europe has already passed regulations for net neutrality. In fact, the fact that it's in the United States is interesting because it's already been agreed elsewhere, and Brazil and so forth. Chile has since 2010. What Obama has behind him is not only the big boys like Google and Facebook and Twitter. He's also got 4.5 million Americans who have actually contacted the Federal Communications Commission to say that they support net neutrality. So, he's got the little boys with him, but interestingly, he's got the big boys as well, except for the biggest boys, which of course are Comcast and Verizon, who are the internet providers that are being held up right now.
Which is where, staying with you on this point, Kathleen, this becomes yet another one of those absurd party political arm wrestles where the facts matter rather less than who is making the claims. Is there a coherent argument against it? Senator Ted Cruz, granted that he is a risible, posturing blowhard, but nonetheless has called net neutrality, and I'm not making this up, this was a thing he actually said out loud, Obamacare for the internet. Does that actually mean anything at all?
No, except that it means that Obama's for it, and thus I'm against it. I don't think it's purely just party political here. In fact, I think it does cross party lines.
Economic power politics, as you say, the big boys against the very big boys.
but the big boys in this case, as Kathleen was saying, are actually quite big boys. All the big tech companies, Google, Facebook, Amazon, Twitter, are all lined up behind the president. That's surely a match, is it not, for the likes of Verizon and Comcast?
Verizon and Comcast have got amazing lobbying prowess behind them. They have paid, well, we won't say an obscene number, but they have behind them the lawyers and first-class lobbyists that could produce, well, their very own protest movement, I suppose one might say. It's touch and go on this. It really is, because you do have some of the point is what net neutrality means is more regulation. It doesn't mean you can do what you want. It means that
it sounds like it would mean the opposite, doesn't it? It sounds like it would be this wonderful anarchic free-for-all. But
no, what it means is that we will regulate to make sure the net is neutral. And so the others are saying in the fine American way, let us go and unbound and be free and so forth. So it is a very much more convoluted thing than it looks like on the surface.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, Kathleen Burke and Sebastian Borger. When we return, we'll be looking at the different ways that Armistice Day is commemorated across Europe. Stay tuned.
The new issue of Monocle is all about building a better life, literally. That's because it contains our autumn design survey aimed at creating the home you want. But there's a lot more to get your teeth into. In the design section, we head to Toronto to reveal the new Aga Khan Museum.
In the edit section, we head to Manhattan for a gin martini and a spot of supper with the dapper journalist Gay Talesi for his last meal.
The November issue of Monocle is on newsstands now. Go out and buy yourself a copy, or better still, become a subscriber. Visit monocle.com to find out how. Monocle, keeping an eye on the world.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly audio guide to the world's best business minds. From industry giants and family outfits to the one-man bands and clever upstarts.
We saw all this immense amount of frustration by young people finding their first jobs, their second jobs, internships. And we said it's ridiculous that in this day and age, with all the technology we have, we can't solve that.
Tune in at 1900 hours London time every Wednesday to hear insider tips, big challenges, and sparks of insight. We take an hour-long tour of the worlds of fashion to food, timepieces to tech, and hear the founding stories of some of the smartest names around.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Pictet.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Kathleen Burke and Sebastian Borger. Now, yesterday's commemoration of Armistice Day here in Britain, at least, was lent added gravitas by the fact that this year marks the 100th anniversary of the beginning of the Great War, and by the extraordinary public interest in Paul Cummins' blood-swept lands and seas of red, an installation of nearly 900,000 ceramic poppies in the moat of the Tower of London. Sebastian, I'll ask you first, how different a commemoration is Armistice Day in Germany? Because, of course, in Western Europe, it signifies the end of the Great War, whereas for Germany, that date really signified the beginning of something much worse.
Well, it also signifies the armistice. That's what it is, Armistice Day. And, of course, we've had the very interesting suggestion of a UK political leader saying it should have gone on for another 6 weeks and forced Germany into an unconditional surrender. Fascinating idea.
This being Nigel Farage of the UK Independence Party. I'm not sure we have to describe him as a political leader just yet. a few other epithets leap more readily to mind.
All right, fine.
But it's a family programme.
It's very simple, I think. The British still talk about the Great War. Nobody in Germany would even think of calling it that. It's the first, and then came the second, which totally trumped the first. We lost them both, but of course, and there is this, I think, rather overwhelming narrative that one led to the other. So I think the second has taken over in our imagination. But there are very somber, very I think dignified, low key events, like the one yesterday in near Arras, where the French opened this new memorial commemorating soldiers from all sides. Rather different from the moat in the tower, from all sides in the northern front in France. 550,000 names on this very impressive memorial, I thought.
Kathleen, yesterday was, of course, also Veterans Day in the United States. Are you struck by a difference in tone between the way it's commemorated there and here?
This is unfair because I've not lived in America for some time, but I do remember my grandfather was fought in the First World War and indeed had a flag in our front garden until the day he died. And there it is more of a, well, it's veterans. It's dedicated to the soldiers, as opposed to armistice, which in a sense over in this country, I think means everyone. Yes, obviously those who lost their lives, but especially in the Second World War, more people lost their lives in Britain than lost them fighting overseas. So it's more complicated. In the U.S., it's for the soldiers. It's the Veterans Day, and they're celebrated, and there are marches, and you stand with your, you know, pledging allegiance, and you hear the trumpets blow and so forth. So I suppose not so much different from the British Legion marching down the high street in my village, but somehow there's a more, well, militaristic, not in a bad term, but really a feeling of
martial.
Well, that has a bad, almost Germanic tone about it, doesn't it? But I'm fuddling for the word here, but I think the idea, the focus is on the soldier rather than on the whole community, I think, in the United States.
Sebastian, that point you made there, that, and you know, it is only to state the obvious, that there were these two cataclysmic world wars, both of which were lost by Germany, and you've spent enough time in Britain that you will have heard all the jokes, so I'm not going to run through those again.
But very kind.
But does that fact, because this is what strikes me, and I've not spent nearly as much time in Germany as I would like to have, but it strikes me that Germany has ended up being unusually honest about its own history with itself in a way that very few countries are.
Well, I suppose we had special reason to be honest with ourselves, and it took us 20 years to get going. But yeah,
some countries never get there. Some countries never manage to completely address.
I talked to
Japan, for example.
Well, I talked
Japan being the most obvious comparison.
I talked to a Berliner who made it out of Germany in the 30s and is now aged 92 here in London. Always, to be honest, the most moving encounters I have in this country. Just knowing that people survived because Britain stood up to Hitler in 1940 on their own. But anyway, and we talked about Austria. Austria sort of sheltered under the cover of being the first victim and never really got going. Never really got going. I agree, but what I find in a way more interesting is the question of how you deal with it now, when the First World War is 100 years away and the second 75. Are we commemorating the event as partners and allies, or are we going back into our national spheres? And it seems to me, I'm only suggesting that here, that there is a tendency in Britain to slightly wrapped up in the whole anti-European idea, is slightly going into their own shell again. And I have to say, I went down to the tower. It was very moving in its own way. It's a marvelous spectacle. This red carpet on green, but it is only the soldiers of the British Empire, and I thought we had moved beyond that, to be honest.
My own pet theory as a non-British person who's lived here a long time is honestly that a lot of there's an instinctive British Euroscepticism, there's part of them still, I think, that hears of some great plan to unify Europe and can't help but think, oh, not this again. This never, ever ends well. I do think it reaches something in them somewhere.
Napoleon, exactly. Hitler, and now Juncker, yes.
Exactly.
Well, okay, yes.
The precedents are not encouraging. We will move along, finally, to a less earthbound and hopefully more hopeful story, which is that a little over 2 hours ago, the Philae lander from the European Space Agency's Rosetta spacecraft ended a decade-long journey of 6 billion kilometres to land almost precisely on schedule on a comet orbiting the sun at a speed of roughly 135,000 kilometres an hour. And yet you try buying a printer that does what you tell it to. Kathleen, I'll ask you first. Is there anything to say about this other than that this is just obviously completely marvellous?
Well, the hope is we'll find out a little bit more about the origins and of the solar system by going 20 centimeters down in the soil and bringing up microscopic bits so it will be analyzed. You know, we will learn things. Yes, we will, and things will have been invented to enable this to happen, which is good, software, hardware, and so forth. But you know, I think there's a lot to be said for the spirit of adventure. For not being earthbound. And I was sorry myself when the space program ended. I was sorry when the moon program ended. And I'm rather happy, in fact, I'm more than happy, that Europe has picked up the baton that the United States has dropped.
But it's that sense of adventure that gets me about it. I mean, I speak as somebody who is a complete scientific and technological idiot. I couldn't possibly care less whether this thing ever actually finds out anything useful or not. If it does, all the better. But if it doesn't, still, it's fantastic.
Well, that's rather what I was saying.
It's just a completely amazing thing to have done.
It may cure your printer eventually.
No, I think that you are just expecting miracles.
And a better frying pan, remember.
And a better frying pan, there is that as well. But Sebastian, is this an advertisement potentially for the European Union, for European unity, for the continent working together?
I think it's completely marvellous. is it an advertisement? It shows scientists work together on that basis and happily, in CERN, in Geneva,
indeed,
and in Darmstadt in Germany and in all the other places, Cullum near Oxford. Scientists are a great community, and the European Union puts money into it, and yeah, that's all very well. But the best thing about all of this is that the comet is called 67P/Churyumov-Gerasimenko.
Well done.
Isn't that great?
Based on the two Soviets who discovered the comet.
No, it's a completely fantastic story. Would that everything the EU did worked with such efficiency. Absolutely extraordinary
Amen
story.
To that.
Absolutely extraordinary story. We will have to leave it there. Kathleen Burke and Sebastian Borger, thank you both very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦, 这是 Monocle 24.
Op London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And there's plenty still coming up in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll meet our man in Madrid. We'll review the latest in radio and television, among many other things. But before we get started on all that, Paul Osborne is here with the headlines.
Well, after all the celebrations after the successful landing of a European probe on a comet, there may be a problem. It appears the harpoons that were meant to hold the probe on the comet's surface didn't fire properly. It's not clear if that will hamper the mission. It holds out the prospect of learning a huge amount about the origins of the solar system. The lander from the Rosetta probe lowered itself onto the surface of the comet while both were travelling at 66,000 kilometres an hour. The World Health Organization has announced that the number of people known to have died in the Ebola outbreak in West Africa has now passed 5,100. In Mali, 90 people are under quarantine in the capital, Bamako, after a nurse died from Ebola who treated a man from Guinea who had symptoms of the disease. Russia's dismissed claims from NATO's most senior commander that it's moved troops and military equipment into eastern Ukraine this week. It's described that allegation as hot air and says there's no evidence. But General Philip Breedlove said he was sure that Russia has stepped up military activities in areas under the control of pro-Moscow separatists. Separately, Russia's military has announced that it's restoring long-range patrol flights by bomber aircraft last seen during the Cold War. The flights will extend as far as the Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.
Welcome back to Midori House. You're live on Monocle 24. It's 21:33 now in Moscow. I think that sounds right. It's definitely 18:33 in London, 14:33 in Rio. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today we're heading to Madrid, from where we are joined by Liam Aldus. First of all, Liam, unofficial vote on Catalan sovereignty held on Sunday. The Prime Minister has been uncharacteristically quiet and quite weirdly quiet in the circumstances. He has now finally spoken. What has he said?
Did you say uncharacteristically quiet? Because it's one of Rajoy's trademarks to actually not speak much at all. So the fact that he was giving a press conference today 72 hours after the vote was a news story in itself. He doesn't usually call surprise press conferences. They're just booked into his agenda or his diary well ahead in advance. But yes, he did speak and he even took questions. He's also famous for wheeling out a plasma TV screen, giving press conferences from a screen and not allowing questions. So today he actually allowed about 8 questions, but before he gave a bit of a speech and he basically didn't really say anything new, to much of a surprise. He said that the whole vote had been a profound failure of the secessionist project. He said that it wasn't even a consultation, it was a sham. And then he just said that his door is always open to negotiation, but he's not going to negotiate on the breakaway of a province from Spain. There's no negotiation as far as that's concerned. So he did take a lot of questions. He responded quite well. It was quite surprising, but he didn't really say anything new, unfortunately.
He's not wrong, though, is he? This whole thing has been kind of a bust, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, if you're in Barcelona, try saying that publicly or loudly on the street. I was there, obviously, on Sunday, and a lot of people were very happy to at least be able to vote or at least engage in an exercise of catharsis to kind of have a bit of a circuit breaker for all this pressure that's been building up. A lot of people were quite happy. But then again, on the other side, 2/3 of people didn't vote. A lot of the people I talked to said, what's the point? I'm not even sure that the guarantees are there. The census isn't involved. How are they going to record if I'm voting yes or no? There was a lot of distrust in the whole process. A lot of people stayed home. But one should not ignore the sentiment that is growing in Catalonia. It's definitely very present on the streets and in every conversation. And it's sometimes very tense. So people in Madrid have a tendency to, and especially the government, to discredit the whole process. But they do that at their own peril, I think.
The question is, I guess, what that 2/3 of people not bothering to vote actually signifies, whether they just didn't think this was a serious referendum or whether they don't actually care one way or the other. Do you think that, you know, if there was, or do people think that, you know, if there was an actual serious referendum akin to the one in Scotland a few weeks ago, that the turnout might have been rather higher?
I definitely, yeah, that's the definite sentiment. It would have been higher. The result, who knows? Because like I was saying on our coverage on Monday, there just hasn't really been a no campaign, even though there hasn't really been an official vote. A lot of the arguments being thrown around are all in favor, and there's no one really to rebut them. So it's been quite interesting to see the whole debate focused around, can people vote? What's going to happen on the day of the voting? The technicalities. There hasn't been a serious debate about what's going to happen if independence is achieved. What does it mean for Catalonia? What does it mean for the economy? What does it mean for pensions? None of those questions are really being answered. So it would be interesting to see if there was a referendum and people came to the table and there was a real public debate, not just about the nitty-gritty of will the government step in and take away the ballot boxes, which is what the whole argument was focused around.
Okay, well, moving on to a much sillier but somewhat more entertaining story. Most of us, if you've lived long enough, you will hear terrible stories of what medical students do get up to with the leftover or no longer needed human containers with which they're allowed to experiment. But a school of medicine, I understand, is trying to explain how a mummified corpse ended up on their roof.
Yes, the case of the mummy on the roof. So this has actually been a long-standing controversy involving the School of Medicine, the Complutense University in Madrid. In May, actually, there was reports, complaints from people in the faculty saying that the faculty was actually conducting private autopsies for the fee of about 100 to 150 euros because they were starved of funds, probably as a result of major cutbacks to education. And there were corpses piling up in the storage facilities in the basement, and they were complaining that it was getting a little out of control. So that was one controversy. And then we have this case just in the last few days of the fact that a university professor stumbled upon a facility which is on top of the roof. It wasn't just this mummy scattered or draped in the gutter or something. It was actually a room on top of the main structure, and there was actually not just a mummy found. There were skeletons, fetuses, detached heads. No one knows how they got there, how long they've been there for, whether it was just kind of locked away and forgotten about. There was a lot of dust there, which is the only indication of how long it's been closed for, but there hasn't really been any explanation. No one can really explain, or maybe they don't want to explain.
Please do stick with that story, Liam. I do look forward to coming back to that one as it develops, because somebody's going to have to come up with a reason, which I do suspect is going to be rather special when we get it. Finally, we need to talk about the closing down of a well-loved shopping mall.
Yeah, it's a kind of a very alternative, a bit of a sad story, actually. It's an alternative shopping mall on the Fuencarral shopping strip, which opened in 1998. It was based around, the alternative markets in London at a time when Madrid was kind of very classic and traditional, and it kind of brought a lot of the alternative culture to the streets. It's been open for a long time, and it's just been sold, apparently, last week. It was confirmed, actually, for a fee of 22 million euros, the structure, and it means the market's going to close down. So there's rumors that a big chain, perhaps H&M, perhaps Inditex, is going to take over the building. And it really shows how the development of the area. The area was very in disrepair. In 1998, it was full of prostitutes and drugs. And now it's become one of the main shopping districts in the city. So perhaps it championed that success. And now it's a victim of that success and it's closing down. Sign of the times.
So what is likely to replace it? Will it just be another generic shopping mall like every other shopping mall in Western Europe?
Well, it's probably going to be remodeled and turned into a big chain store. That's the what people are saying. But there's another big development as well. In January, a 30-year-old rental agreement, which has kept a lot of the rents low in a lot of the major cities in Spain, particularly in Barcelona and Madrid, will come to an end. And a lot of the low rents that have sustained these very, very small business across the city will be renegotiated. We may see a lot of this happening across the city. There could be a coming retail apocalypse as far as the big cities are concerned, but I guess I'll be covering that story as well in January.
But please do, Liam, stay on that rooftop mummy story. We do want to hear where that goes. For the moment, though, Liam Aldous in Madrid, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. Up next, we're heading to New York.
What do you need to build a better city? Tech-savvy urban app builders, hipsters, will take a neglected hood and fill it with quality coffee stores and too many beards. A mayor who's a hard hitter and crack-free, or perhaps some oddballs to liven things up and keep the world a little less well-behaved. On our show, The Urbanist, we've met them all, and many more extraordinary and ordinary people besides, who form the chorus for a good city show.
If all we build is concrete and glass boxes with nothing really cool in between them, it's not as interesting or sustainable or valid a place to live as we're used to. So we got to get back to that thinking.
This one-hour program looks at all the key urban debates, from density to smart cities, but it's not a talking shop for those who think they know best. The Urbanist makes the city human, sees the quirks and contradictions that turn a collection of buildings into a place where people actually want to live. Join us each week on the only show about the cities we live in. It's hosted by me, Andrew Tuck, and it premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours. Join us.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, coming up for 1842 here in London. But if you are listening in New York or you are on your way there, you've three more days to catch Independent 2014 taking place at Centre 548 in the former Dear Art Foundation building in Chelsea. Joining me now with more on the event is its creative advisor, Matthew Higgs. Matthew, welcome to the programme. You opened on November 6th, I think I'm right in saying. How is it going so far?
It's been great. The first 4 days of independent projects took the form of an art fair. And then in the second week, which is open till this Saturday, it sort of becomes a more hybrid exhibition, which is open to the public every day from noon till 7 p.m. and it's free.
And how is that combination of exhibition and art fair working in practice?
I think, you know, the original independent art fair, which began about 4 years ago, was an attempt to somehow break away from the sort of trade show, trade fair aesthetics common to a lot of art fairs, to try and create a platform that artists themselves were actually interested in working in, thinking about, and making work for. I think a lot of artists sort of, treat art fairs with some skepticism. And the idea with independent was to actually create a platform that artists actually wanted to engage with. So the idea was to create something that was more of a hybrid, that it operated both as a marketplace, but also as an exhibition itself. And I think central to that idea was sort of engaging with innovative architects who were very kind of sort of sensitive to how artists work. So this year, for example, we worked with Jonathan Kaplan from Project Space Architects in New York, and he's worked closely with some galleries such as Gavin Brown, Friedrich Petzl in New York. So he's very sensitive to the needs of artists, and he created a very kind of dynamic an open floor plan at the Independent Projects exhibition, which allows for artists to sort of really make significant new work or to present work in a kind of new and illuminating way.
Is there a big shift in atmosphere, I guess, in the kind of crowds that turn up between the exhibition part and the art fair part?
Well, I think there's definitely a different dynamic at Independent generally. You know, I think one of the sort of paradoxes of the successes of art fairs internationally is that almost too many people show up now. So we've seen some of the bigger fairs selling tickets in advance. restricting the number of people that can attend each day and so forth. So there's a kind of, think of a desire from galleries and artists to sort of scale this back a little and to have much more intimate engagements with art, and also to have a different kind of conversation around art that, you know, is for sale. So in the first week at Independent Projects, it was very busy. A lot of people coming through who are interested in buying the work, talking to dealers about artists they were unfamiliar with. And then this week, it does take the form of an exhibition. So it's right in the heart of New York's Chelsea Gallery District. And just a casual passerby can come in and see 40 presentations by 40 artists of all generations.
And are there any works or artists you've been noticing attracting particular attention or surprising amounts of attention?
Well, I think one of the things we tried to do when we were thinking about the invitations to galleries, and then in the conversations we had with galleries about who they might bring, we were interested for people to bring, you know, idiosyncratic work, work that would be new to a lot of the audience in New York City, and to try and create a real mix, so between self-taught and outsider artists, between historical positions, established artists, and also emerging. So it runs the whole gamut. And I think, you know, one of the sort of standouts in the first week was the presentation of a sculptural tableau by Dwayne Hansen, who was known for creating these lifelike sculptures that, you know, you make a double take when you first see them. And it's of a Florida lady at a flea market. And it's been presented by one of the most innovative publishers and bookstore galleries in New York, Karma. So they're presenting a historical work. Then other galleries were presenting Andrew Edlin, who's one of the galleries in New York City that presents some of the most extraordinary outsider art, is presenting the work of Thornton Dial, an artist from the American South who's self-taught, and he's presenting these really key historical pieces by him. Liam Gillick, a British artist based in New York City, is presenting a new video work that looks at the life, work, and legacy of the British artist Richard Hamilton. So we're seeing that for the first time in New York as well. So the idea really was to, you know, create some sort of new things for people to see in New York City, even if you're familiar with the contemporary art scene here.
And how was the, is there a sort of major difference between this and the event that you hold in March?
I think the event in March, which is called The Independent, focuses on galleries' programs. So typically, a gallery might present three or four artists. The Independent in March tends to focus on the work of emerging artists or younger artists. What we were interested to do with Independent Projects was create a real mix. So between, you know, Dominique Levy Gallery showing the work of Eve Klein, to, you know, a really smart younger gallery from London, Carlos Ishikawa, to the space that I run in New York City called White Columns, we're presenting the work of June Hamper, who's now 87 years old. She's also the mother of the artist and musician Billy Childish. So with Independent Projects, we wanted to focus on individual positions. So it's a sequence of 40 solo presentations. And I think the character of the exhibition is quite distinct to the Independent that takes place in March.
Matthew Higgs, Creative Advisor of Independent 2014. Thank you very much for joining us. For further details on the show stroke art fair, you can see independentnewyork.com. Time now for some music on Midori House as we come up for 1848 here in London. We were just speaking to Matthew Higgs of Independent 2014 from our New York bureau, so we will stay on the New York track, though I've been overruled again. This is Odyssey with Native New Yorker. Odyssey with Native New Yorker. It's just gone 1852 in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Time now for our daily arts review. Today we are talking television and radio with the broadcast writer Alice Vincent. Alice, welcome to the show. First, we wanted to talk about Serial. This is NPR's new thing, which is getting fantastic reviews and to which I've barely listened to 10 seconds of. It's not The Archers, is the impression I'm getting.
No, mainly because it's based on real life. and even as someone from the country, The Archers is not. Yeah, it's incredible. So it is from the makers of This American Life, who obviously deal with real stories anyway. And in short, the presenter, Sarah Koenig, she makes her way through this detective series of a murder that's been done. And every week she's finding out as much as you are.
Okay, and how is, I mean, it does seem, the idea of a radio serial seems almost a kind of, well, retro, really. Does it work, though? Does it acknowledge everything that has happened since the wireless was invented, or is it determined to just be an old-fashioned radio serial? Though obviously most people aren't actually listening to it on the radio, I wouldn't imagine.
No, it's very much podcast. I think it doesn't try to modernize itself, and I think that's why it's successful. Suddenly, for the first time in a number of years, people are excited every Thursday to get the latest update. That's something we've not had with television for a really long time.
And they've gone ahead and called it Serial and everything. This is a clip from it.
Previously on Serial.
Did anybody else use the phone?
Yeah, Adnan, I remember he was talking to a girl. He put me on the phone with her for like 3 minutes. I said hello to her.
I just remember he had told my daughter he had seen the body of a girl in the back of in the trunk of some vehicle.
I think the guy's name was maybe Adnan.
That's a clip from Serial, NPR's new serial. I've always wanted to say previously on. Yeah. We don't get to do that. No. It'd be brilliant. Previously on Midori House. wanted to move along to television. This is a much ballyhooed. I've also always wanted to say much ballyhooed. I think that may be a first. New television drama, How to Get Away with Murder. Is it as good as people are saying it is?
Yes, it's, I mean, anything that comes out of Shonda Rhimes or Shondaland, who is the executive producer behind it and the master behind Grey's Anatomy, is, you know, people almost know what you're going to get. And it is good. It's entertaining. It's not perfect, but it's fun. Basically, there is this defence attorney, and she takes a very tough law class in criminal law. And her classmates, she makes her students help solve a crime. And this story is running parallel to a murder that's going on, or a murder mystery that's going on.
Okay, well, we also have a clip from How to Get Away with Murder. It sounds like this.
You got him to lie on the stand.
I did my job. Everything after this moment will not only determine your career, but life. You can spend it in a corporate office drafting contracts and hitting on chubby paralegals before finally putting a gun in your mouth. Or you can join my firm and become someone you actually like.
I want to be her.
From How to Get Away with Murder. Good, apparently.
Yeah, fun.
How to Get Away with Murder, it's fun. Okay, well, moving from things which are fun, even though they sound like they might not be, to something that was supposed to be fun but really, really wasn't, the bizarre, short-lived career of Dapper Laughs. I don't know where to begin explaining this to people who may not be up with the story. It kind of reads like a Martin Amis satire of 21st century media. But basically, and I think I've got the details right, annoying comedian becomes popular online with clips of himself sexually harassing women, which ITV2, an allegedly respectable broadcast network, decide to commission into a series and are then surprised when almost everybody hates it.
Yes.
Have I missed anything?
That's a very good summary, yes.
Okay. How did this... I mean, we do have a clip of it, which really... Nah. I don't think we're going to. It was one of those things I did watch, like a lot of people, about 30 seconds of, absolutely baffled as to how this happened. Do we understand how crap like this actually gets commissioned?
I kind of feel like at some point along the commissioning lines at ITV, someone said, oh, this guy, he's got 600,000 Vine followers. Vine is like Twitter, but with video. He's got to be good. There's loads of vlogger interest. Let's make a show with him. And in theory, that doesn't sound like such a terrible idea, except I don't know how they watched those Vine clips and didn't realise that he had really terrible sense of humour. So, yeah, the misogynistic elements, the homelessness, baiting, all really inappropriate stuff.
He has since done the inevitable, tearfully wretched, semi-apologetic interview wearing black polo neck on Serious News programme, trying to say it was all just a character, he was doing a thing, it was self-satire, etc. Were you buying any of that?
No, not really. I think he was apologising for being found out. I don't think he was apologising for his character.
That was exactly the impression I got. Hopefully we need never hear or speak his name again. Just finally, Netflix's adaptation of the Lemony Snicket books.
Sure. I'm so excited about this. This is the first Netflix original series to be for children, for one. So, and going on what they've done in the past, which has always been, with the exception of Hemlock Grove, really strong, I think that... Lemony Snicket, for those who don't know, is a widely successful series of children's books which have a very macabre sense of humour. Netflix does dark and funny very well, like Orange is the New Black. So,
and this is worth looking forward to?
Absolutely.
See, we will have to wrap it up there, unfortunately. I'm just one of those, I'm keeping Netflix out of the house for fear I will never go outside again if I sign up for it. Alice Vincent, arts and entertainment writer, thank you very much for joining us. That is all for this edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our earlier guests, Kathleen Burke and Sebastian Borger. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by David Pleasant and Alia Masood. Our studio managers were Chad Chalvers and Sean Malervi. 2200 hours tonight in 3 hours from now. That's right, isn't it? 10 minus 7, that's 3, is the Monocle Daily with Emma Nelson and Nancy Durham. I'll be back with Midori House at 1800 time, London time tomorrow. But for this edition, from me, Andrew Muller, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world-famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.